Hello, this is Classic Friendship, episode 3, the one with the stories. In this podcast is Matthew Cunningham, Rosanna McLaughlin, Megan Rooney and Anne Hirsch, and the musical indents are made by Lyndon Harrison. It's January 2014.
Countess!
There are two works by Matthew Cunningham in this podcast. This is Matthew Cunningham 1.
The laughter comes from within the sofa as it sucks you and your cup of tea into it, bites you, teases you, puts a Guinness hat on your head, says happy birthday, and releases you, unconscious, into the attic of a four-story apartment block halfway down France, or halfway up. Some part of you hears the tread of the boots as if they are your own, but as you're lying down, it seems unlikely. The door is flung open. Enter the gendarmerie, say, and start rifling through your possessions. You wake up, bleary, happy, scared, as they throw poems at your head and stones at your heart. One stone hits the spot and breaks in two. One poem means something, and together you reveal a landscape black and blue through which the cretins march by torchlight. All the dead celebrities are streaming towards an endlessness that unfurls eternally. The world tips. On closer inspection, you see the mud under their nails and the glue in their hair. It's a real botch job, and the sun will never rise, but André Breton is busy telling Judy Garland about Dali's face. Judy Garland is telling John Belushi about her first ever job. John Belushi is telling Sigmund Freud about Wordsworth. Sigmund Freud is telling Mark Bolan about what Mark Bolan should do tomorrow. Again, Mark Bolan is telling Sylvia Pankhurst about wrong meat. Sylvia Pankhurst is telling Frida Kahlo about gold, and Frida Kahlo is telling Captain Hook about how they're all going to get there eventually. Just you wait and see, Captain. We'll get there. In the cold light of the interrogation room, your feet are bent. A disco light, lying in the corner of the room, is plugged in, but the plug switch is off. If only you could release yourself from these cuffs, scamper across the floor and switch that switch. If only. A gust of wind picks up a boat. The mirage sends a lamb insane. Canary Wharf is burning down. You close your eyes again. You open your eyes. You are doing something else. You are doing two things, maybe three, maybe four, and the gendarmerie peer down at you. You doing your things, itching your neck. Even though you are chained, there is still almost nothing you can't do. This is your holiday. Whatever happens is funny. You feel a hand on your neck. Two hands. A third on your shoulder and a fourth on the other. A hood is placed over your head with a mini plasma screen sewn into the lining. Once everybody is settled down, the screen flicks to life. In 1993, Elliot Kaplan directed the Merce Cunningham dance troupe in a film entitled Beach Birds for Camera. It was a fantastic period of everyone's life. Everyone looked great, everyone dressed well, and there was no need for anyone to feel bad or sad. John Cage was involved, and everything's all right when John Cage is involved. The beach birds never fall. The camera always drifts. The feet pitter-patter, 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 pitter-patter. This is what they show you inside your hood. Beach birds for camera. It is a strange dance. Everyone looks gorgeous. This is what they show you. Of all things. It is beautiful how they dance. The chaos is hypnotizing. You want it to go on and on. You forget where you are. It's entrancing. You're only doing one thing. You're actually very happy now. This is an amazing show. You close your eyes and the dance continues. You open your eyes, the birds are still there. The camera's still floating. The feet keep on pitter-pattering. And it's all you ever. It's all you ever. It's all you ever. It's all you ever.
That was Matthew Cunningham, one.
Rihanna!
This is Megan Rooney, Congo Line.
Our unconscious desire had us boarding. This was her private time to drink coffee. Disoriented, suffering from indigestion, she sat looking out the window. Faced with a dilemma of what to say, she elaborated on yesterday's social something. She was making a political argument, mocking the real agents that sat all around her, wearing gold chains and red lipstick. She maintained expressions. Inherent truth formation stood before her. Washboard abs. Owed desire. But down in the food court, she just couldn't make up her mind between freshly squeezed carrot juice or fish fingers. It appears that the logic of her dreams made things confusing. And being there and becoming human at the same time didn't make those decisions any easier. Seasonal rhythms kept her moving in fashionable histories. Accepting old wisdom, she joined the conga line, effectively staking out the memories of the day, formulating passion and something to get us to turn the page. Terror had her trying on gray sweaters. Cashmeres were displayed on the bed, and all the rest we left in the suitcase. In the highest form of togetherness, we lay side by side, waiting for the sun to rise, waiting for the sheets to be changed. Ideal ego pulls on her heartstrings, and you just can't say no. Because every evil genius has a father and eats farmed fish. And your symbolic meltdown matters little. Culture and business own our lives, and with each monotonous step we take, there's a better spot to enjoy coffee. The kiss was long and sweet, and looked how a kiss should look after a couple had been separated for so long. Fantastic obscenity was queen, and she wore them well despite the double eviction. Girls were popping out of cakes, and we videoed him crying at the scene of the crash. His hands were in the cement, leaving his mark for all the nobodies, yours and mine, that would be lured there at some point in the future.
That was Megan Rooney, Congo Line.
Serenade!
This is Rosanna McLaughlin, The Turtle and the Vulture.
As Lewis waited for his cousin Eddie at South Kensington Station, he wondered whether he had chosen the right thing to wear. He'd been daydreaming about tonight's festivities, a party in honour of Eddie's latest exhibition, all week. Bejewelled women with their heads thrown back in laughter had occupied his waking thoughts, as had the golden carpet of opportunities that would subsequently unfurl at his feet. Panicked at the prospect of his wardrobe, Nothing he owned had felt at all synonymous with this new and dazzling incarnation of Lewis Palmer. He had invested half a week's wages on a sterile-looking shirt and a pair of trousers from Gap. The rest had gone towards a set of business cards, embossed with his name and a host of other contact details, including, rather hopefully, the international calling code for the UK. Now that the evening had finally come around, the familiar figure of doubt had wrested back its dominion from the glitterati, and Lewis's giddy fantasies had been replaced by an overwhelming sense of nervousness. It didn't help matters much when Eddie arrived half an hour late, having come straight from his studio in a pair of faded Hawaiian beach shorts and a pink paint-splattered jumper, radiating his usual cavalier charm. Eddie and Lewis followed a line of guests up to the steps of the enormous door of number 50 Thurlow Square. They were greeted by Johanna, who was wearing a star-shaped cap like the police wear in LA, only made of black velvet and with Hollywood written backwards across the crown in silver letters. "Halli, halloo!" she called out cheerfully, blonde plaits swinging as she puckered up to the air around Lewis's cheeks. "Eddie, wonderful to see you. There's someone upstairs who is simply dying to meet you." Lewis listened as his cousin's footsteps disappeared up the wooden staircase before turning tentatively into the front room. Johanna's front room was split into two parts. The back half comprised of a floor-to-ceiling library, complete with wooden ladder should you need to reach the upper shelves, and the walls were indeed high enough to house an elephant. While the front half was full to bursting with artworks and design pieces from Johanna's collection, displayed salon style, one on top of the other. Finding himself alone so soon and surrounded by strangers, Lewis took refuge in a habit he'd developed at private views to avoid looking lonely, studying the artwork. He had been stood up at an opening on East Castle Street a few months before, and had actually looked, and in some detail moreover, at every single artwork on display, successfully managing to diffuse the crippling awkwardness brought on by such events. Lewis scanned the room and decided to begin with a flat-screen monitor playing a film of paint dripping, which was mounted on the wall between a photograph of a dismembered Barbie and a colourful Peruvian-style weave-in. He watched the 3-minute loop for as long as he felt credible, and then moved to the windowsill to examine some colourful ceramics. Midway through weighing up what they looked like more, a stack of bangles or a particularly audacious dildo, a woman in luminous yellow stilettos appeared with Eddie by his side. "Beautiful, aren't they?" she purred in a Russian accent, husky with the memory of late nights and champagne receptions. "There is something about Italian ceramics from the early 1980s. Something so free and exciting, so childish, and yet so erotic," Eddie chipped in emphatically. They all stared at the ceramics expectantly, as if waiting for the profundity of the statement to effect some change in the clay. "Erotique." The Russian turned the word over in her mouth, examining every syllable with her tongue. Having failed to find its new significance, she drifted off across the room to greet a friend. It was around this time that a tall French woman arrived. She was dressed in the kind of outfit favoured by the very rich and the very poor alike, for which the untrained eye requires a context of significant grandeur, or else to see proof of receipt in order to confirm or deny its cheapness. A tight white sweater with a dangerously low neckline. Seen in Johanna's front room, there could be no doubt that it was cashmere. Black quilted ballet pumps complete with a bow and golden monogram. Louis Vuitton, perhaps, or else some other high-end fashion house. And a pair of skin-tight white jeans, which in spite of their cut, flapped around her bony posterior when she walked, like a flag on some windy outpost. "Hello, everyone," she said to nobody in particular. "My mother was supposed to come, but instead, the bitch has arrived." A faint ripple stirred the air, and a few people looked up nonchalantly from their drinks, but nobody seemed much interested in the new arrival. Nobody, that is, except for Lewis, whose heart began to race at the appearance of that mythical beast, who had so far eluded his career, the collector. Being the closest to her, Eddie thrust out his hand. "Eddie, how's it going?" She looked at his outstretched arm for a moment, before limply raising her own. "Céline, my pleasure. You young men, all the same. Be a good boy and get me something white, and tell Johanna I'm here. She'll be worried. She was expecting mummy." Eddie raised his eyebrows, and without saying a word, turned and left the room, leaving Lewis alone with Céline. "So you are one of Johanna's boys? Let me guess. You look like a conceptual. Mummy takes me with her, auctions everywhere. Oh, I know. A conceptual. Don't you agree? I'm here with my cousin Eddie. I helped him install his latest show at Johanna's." Lewis replied, unsure of how best to respond. "But I also run Hausen, a project space in Mile End." Céline looked at him blankly. "Mile End? It's in East London?" "Oh!" she exclaimed, her eyes lighting up. To Céline, like many a West London collector, East London is a veritable turtlehead heaven. A breeding ground for emergent talent, where the intrepid venture to place bets on who will be next to shift solid gold. "I've been to Jay's place, on Oxton Square," she announced proudly, betraying a misconception commonly held by the city's Occidental residents that East is in fact a small village extending no more than 1 mile from Shoreditch Town Hall. "Do you have a card? I'm always interested to see what you conceptuals get up to." Lewis hastily pulled a card from his pocket, feeling pleased with himself for being so well prepared. "It's not your last one. I do hope I haven't stolen your last one, you sweet boy." Céline mewed as she dropped it into the cavernous depths of her large leather handbag. Out of the corner of his eye, Lewis noticed a German artist named Caesar who'd shown at Hausen a while back. For the opening night, he had hung some meticulous oil paintings of trainers on the walls, dimmed the lights and turned the gallery into a club, complete with a laser show, and a DJ had come over from Berlin especially. Caesar was sitting on a stool in the corner of the room, listening intently to a strange young man who seemed to be in the midst of convincing him of the importance of some idea or theory. For all the world, he looked like a politician who had blown his expenses in American apparel, an unnerving combination of rehearsed rhetoric and tie-dye leggings. And Lewis was sure he recognised him from somewhere. Meanwhile, Céline had begun cackling like a lunatic vulture, tossing around the names of famous artists she'd met like so much carrion. Over her shoulder, Lewis watched as the Russian in stiletto heels walked over to Caesar and the tie-dye politician. And he suddenly remembered where he'd seen him before. He'd given a talk in a friend's warehouse a few months ago. Something to do with the internet and free pizza. "Damien, Anish, such naughty boys. Those conceptuals, those YBAs. Don't you agree?" Céline insisted, having said nothing in particular. Not wanting to anger this dangerous bird, Lewis looked up at her and nodded with as much sincerity as he could muster. Céline was one of those people in whom one could practically smell an unholy mess, and thus far Lewis had been careful to avoid her eyes, instinctively aware of that diabolical something lurking just beneath the surface. Now, as he scanned her features for the first time, he realised he had absolutely no idea how old she was. Her cheeks and forehead were perfectly smooth, solid even, but around her eyes, little black holes bored into yellow marble, was a centimetre or so of papery wrinkles which had evidently escaped the surgeon's knife. Time, that most dogged of critics, was making a concerted effort to wind the clock's hands back to where they rightfully belonged. "I've just got back from Venice, of course. Were you there?" No, Lewis replied politely. But I've always wanted to go. Oh, you're too poor, Celine responded triumphantly, stretching out the words like a playground taunt. Johanna would have to smug you in her suitcase. It had now been a quarter of an hour since Eddie had left in search of white wine, and Lewis, keen to escape, suggested they went through to the garden. He followed Celine into the kitchen, observing a wobble in her gait, and slipped off out the back door at the first opportunity. He spotted Eddie standing with a group of unfamiliar people at a makeshift bar. Hey, where you been? Eddie called out, as if oblivious to the fact that he had abandoned him. Everybody, this is my cousin Lewis. Lewis said hi to the group, a glamorous French woman, some lesbians who ran a gallery in their flat in a tower block, and a digital artist from New York who Johanna had flown over to see the show, wearing what could only be described as orthopedic sandals and a monk's robe. Try some of this. Eddie poured Lewis a glass of fizzy red wine. It's fucking weird stuff, man. Johanna's family have their own vineyard. What happened to you? I've been talking to that woman for ages. Who? Oh, her. Yeah, she's nuts. Clementine, hi. So glad you can make it. Catch you later, Lewis. Alone again. Lewis stood at the bar for a while, where he found he could refill his glass and watch the various goings on in relative comfort. Johanna's courtyard was small, and amongst the immaculately raked gravel floor, enormous watermelons had been placed like a Zen fruit salad. There were tables of food laid out, mountains of pears and whole cheeses still in their packaging, stacked up in pyramids. The evening's guests were a mixture of wealthy Europeans and interesting types that Johanna had collected. The beautiful poor, the vibrant young, the gay, or at the very least, the visibly eccentric. And Lewis watched them drift through this improbable landscape, either too much at home to notice, or too proud to acknowledge the absurdity of splendour. Inside, a buffet was being served, and guests had begun to appear in the courtyard with plates of food. Lewis, who had been standing at the bar for some time and had felt himself dangerously near the cliff face of drunkenness, decided it would be wise to follow suit. In the kitchen, Johanna was busy directing a pair of young women, dressed in black and white service attire, who were stacking asymmetrical plates on a long glossy table and replenishing the dishes. To Lewis's surprise, all the food was round. Miniature balls of cheese, baby tomatoes in a variety of different colours, meatballs and lavender profiteroles. Even the tureen at the end of the table was filled with pea soup. He was gingerly placing the few spherical objects on his plate, unsure how to approach a meal with such formal rigour, when he noticed a large canvas attached to the ceiling above his head. Looking up at it from below, he thought of mirrored ceilings in porny hotel rooms that allow you to watch yourself in the act. He felt dominated by the alien spread. Outside in the courtyard, the flow of alcohol had begun to heat things up, melting the edges of the day. Tongues and collars were loosened, and abandoned inhibitions, jetted into the night sky on the back of wild laughter, had formed a dangerous canopy over the party, like a cloud of burning ash above a bonfire. Celine had been sitting for some time on a bench in the corner, radiating reckless heat. Two pretty young men had been amusing themselves with her for some time and had just slunk off in search of wine, and Lewis, by now portraying the slippery confidence of a man half drunk, sauntered over to her.
Do you have a cigarette? I need a cigarette, she said, fumbling around inside her bag.
I'm afraid I don't smoke.
Fucking, well, I don't know. Where is it? What do you... Do you have a cigarette?
She demanded again, oblivious to the fact that she had asked only a moment ago. Lewis noticed that something about her had changed. If earlier she seemed to have only a loose grip on reality, she had by now completely let go of the rope, and was instead being buffeted about the evening by the turbulent winds of intoxication. Perhaps I could find you one? With her head lost in her bag, the contents of which were now strewn across the floor, she muttered in the affirmative. Lewis sprung to his feet. Rather than perturbing him, Celine's diminishing state gave room for his own unreality to resurface, and he headed towards the bar, the picture of chivalry, ready to win over the heart of a bejeweled woman. He tried a few groups, and having no luck in the garden, he decided to head indoors. On a sofa in the corner of the kitchen, a young man in a turquoise salwar chemise and matching eyeshadow was lying across the lap of a large woman, who was running her plump fingers through his hair. Lewis bounded over. "Excuse me, there's a woman outside who very much wants a cigarette. I don't suppose you've got one going spare?" The young man looked up at him sanctimoniously. "Is it for her out there? No fucking way. She's been asking all night for all kinds of things. It's disgusting. It looks like she's got some of what she's after anyway." His plump companion drew his pale head into the folds of her bosom and glared at Lewis accusingly, as if she were a nursemaid sworn to protect the tranquility of this delicate young Raja. Lewis returned to the garden empty-handed and disheartened, to find Celine attempting to transfer the tobacco from a broken Marlboro light into the sheet of a cigarette paper. All was not lost. Sensing her mounting distress, Lewis offered to take over, managing to fashion a lumpen but nevertheless smokable cigarette. He handed it to her, and without a word she got up to her feet, steadied herself, and went off in search of a lighter, leaving Lewis on the bench in the company of the detritus she had left in her wake. A small corner of card, buried beneath the screwed-up receipts and spent cigarette cartons, caught his attention. Turning it over in his hand, Lewis recognised his phone number and the letters L-E-W-I-S-P printed across the front, and the rest of his name had been torn off for a filter. It was by now nearing midnight, and the party was beginning to wind down. Johanna had resumed her position in the hallway, kissing the procession of cheeks, making their way out into the Kensington night. With Eddie nowhere to be seen, Lewis found himself standing with the 10 or so hangers-on, gulping down wine, chasing the evening's inevitable death. There were no longer enough voices in the garden to keep the canopy aloft, and an uneasy atmosphere descended upon 50 Furlough Square. One man, not content with the evening's haul, was attempting to wrestle a large wheel of untouched cheese into his rucksack. On discovering that Lewis was watching him, he shrugged his shoulders, gave up on the rucksack, and went to say goodbye to Johanna with it tucked brazenly under his arm. Celine was prowling amongst the watermelons, in the hope of finding something to stay, if only for a moment, her terrible hunger. One by one she singled out the remaining guests, who replied with the uninvested apology usually reserved for beggars on busy high streets, delivered automatically in the knowledge that the same question will always be asked and the same answer will always be given. She walked up to Lewis. "Excuse, you have a cigarette?" she said, fixing him with an expression of perfect blankness. He shook his head. "No, I'm sorry." Before he had finished his sentence, she had moved on, and he addressed his apology to the empty wine bottle and the empty sky which stood before him. Celine turned impatiently towards the house and stepped through the doorway. Lewis watched her gaunt figure, suddenly illuminated by the kitchen lights, and noticed, with horror, that she was bleeding between her legs, soiling her bright white jeans.
That was Rosanna McLaughlin, The Turtle and the Vulture.
Tonight.
And I love your hair.
Thank you.
And I love your hair. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I love your hair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I love your hair. Thank you.
This is Matthew Cunningham, too.
She knew what she enjoyed because she kept doing it, but others weren't convinced. The others said there's unfair pressure on her. They were right. So what about her enjoyment? How does that fit in? It seems that what she enjoys is not particular to the thing, but more to the pressure put on her by it. Sunrise dreams of sunrise. She wakes and refuses to concurrently until she remembers. Mary Margaret O'Hara, when you know why you're happy. Helped out of yesterday's clothes and into the day before's. Early into consciousness, she feels nervous. Less detectable now, though, more like herself. She finishes dressing, enough for now at least, and carries on with all the feelings she has converted into breakfast, which is tiny and more than enough. Her neck stretches in the mirror, without eye contact. Toothpaste is better than breakfast. She has to remember that. It doesn't matter whether she chooses or needs to rest. She is resting now because she needs to make a list out of the day. Other people in the house have already used things and got on with their lives, which makes her feel a bit shit, but she understands, kind of, because she didn't get back last night until they were all in bed, and she knows she's pretty empty, energy-wise, at the moment and for a while. It doesn't matter whether she thinks or hopes there are still one or two in bed. She doesn't want herself to be too detailed. She knows she can't wear these clothes, though, and nearly cries. Her body becomes quickly heavy, and her head raises to the height it is when she stands up and walks back to her bedroom. She gently peels the clothes off of her body. She is naked now. Her right hip moves inwards, causing the left to move left. You can see the air. Her left hip pushes back and the toes of her right foot support the shift in weight. She is kind of standing on her toes now, but also rocks. She feels okay, actually. On the way to work, she hits a hole in the road. Her bike and her body crunch together. She doesn't mind the pain because she's a little late to work, but she's worried about her bike. The cars get very close to her and she hates them but finds her hatred unreasonable. What gives her the right to hate cars? Cars hate bikes. Bikes hate cars. Cars hate other cars. Cars are disgusting. Oops. She passes clothes shops she used to go to and re-notices how little time she has before she promised she'd be back at work. Does she mind? It's hard to tell because she thinks she shouldn't, and that's what she feels more than anything. So she carries on and it's not raining, so that's better than yesterday. She thinks about yesterday and knows what she can't and surely won't do again today. It starts to rain, so she cycles faster. She is nearly there.
That was Matthew Cunningham, too. This is the final part of Anne Hirsch's work, Frank the Entertainer in a Basement Affair, a radio play. It's part two.
I just want to interrupt the story here for a minute, as we're about halfway through. So far, Annie and Frank have been getting along so well. Annie's been winning challenges and has even befriended many of the girls. Everyone thinks of her as the sweetest and realest girl in the house. I'm proud of myself for having pushed her to be more outgoing. It's paid off, but as the competition progresses, I wonder how long she can keep it up.
You know, now I think we're down to just who's compatible with Frank, and I'm just trying to figure out whether Frank likes me as a friend or as more.
Question. How do you think you and I would fit together perfectly?
Like, are you talking, like, sexually, or what are
no,
you?
Well, hey, girl, your mind's in the gutter.
Well, like, fit together, I'm like, what are you saying?
We could talk sexually, too, but whatever, everything.
It's always really nice to talk to Annie. She's a really sweet girl. I gotta say, she's always surprising me.
I do love your sense of humor. I think it's so funny.
I just say whatever I want, and I don't care. Like, when I got here, I was like, I don't care what the other girls think of me, you know?
Give me a kiss.
You know, Annie's a really cool chick. Honestly, I really wish I could spend more time with her.
Annie, you're doing so well. You've made it past 5 eliminations. There are only 8 girls remaining.
At this point, I feel like we are connecting. I just wonder if he likes me in the same way.
Girls, get ready for your next challenge. We're going to the Maresca family reunion. You'll have to impress the whole Maresca family to win this one.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, I'm Gary.
Dana.
Hi, this is Kathy. Gary, nice to meet you.
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very good.
Hi, Lori. Hi, I'm Melissa.
Nice to meet you. I'm Lori.
Luann. How are you?
Nice to meet you.
Definitely. I know I'm not the friendliest, most outgoing person, so I know it's going to be hard for me to compete with the other girls on this.
So what I'd like to do now is I'm going to start calling up each lady who's still in the house, and they're going to have a toast to my mother and father from their heart. So ladies, mean it.
Susan and Gary, ever since I walked up to that front stoop, you have been nothing but nice, amazing, gracious, respectful, and very parent-like to me since I came into the house.
I mean, 39 years is really an accomplishment. It's just amazing to see how two people can be so in love after such a long time. I know that everyone here wants that.
Well, I'm gonna try not to cry because I've fallen in love with you guys just as much as I've fallen in love with Frank, I have to admit.
Wow, Mr. and Mrs. Maresca, you both have been so welcoming. You let 15 girls into your home. And I just think the fact that you would do that and tolerate all of us just shows how much love you have for your son.
So everyone in my family voted on who gave the best speech, and the results are in. I'm about to give you some very interesting information.
So basically, the results come out and Carrie and Felicia win everything. Duh. I feel terrible because I was so quiet and reserved and I didn't feel comfortable enough to be myself around these people.
Annie, don't be discouraged. You just need to find alone time with Frank somehow. You can show him that you can be more than just a friend. All the other girls are doing it, like Kathy, for example.
Like, I woke up last night and I heard Kathy's voice and I was like, it must be 3 a.m. or something.
Well, we don't know what they were doing down there in the basement. The cameraman went to bed, so we can't make assumptions.
If Kathy did have sex with Frank, it would really change the dynamic of the house. They would have a bond that no other girl would have with him.
Annie, don't think about what Kathy is doing. Just keep trying to connect with Frank. Step up your game somehow. Make an impression. There are only a few eliminations left. All right, girls, time for eliminations.
Making this decision is really, really tough.
Good evening, ladies. You all look beautiful tonight. Thank you all for coming to my family reunion. As always, beside me are the keys to my basement. If you receive a key to my basement, it means you still have access to my heart. If you do not receive a key to my basement, it means you'll be leaving immediately.
I definitely feel like this could be it for me tonight because I don't know where my connection is with Frank.
Annie, you were on fire with the challenges earlier on, but lately I feel like you've been getting a little lost in the mix, and I need to figure out if we can bring this to the next level. Will you accept this key to my basement?
Duh. When I realized that I was safe, I was like, thank God, because I get to hang out with Frank a bit longer.
Annie got to stay tonight because even though she's fallen behind, we think she has the potential to make a comeback.
We're hoping she'll do one of two things here. Either something really sweet for Frank to push our viewers to root for her as an underdog, or something wonderfully desperate and pathetic so our viewers can laugh at her when Frank kicks her off. I've tried to make her understand that she needs to step up her game and not let the other girls dominate the camera time. But she doesn't seem to be responding to my advice anymore. I think she's pulling away from me. Girls, it's time to get up. You have a long day today and a new challenge.
Now, ladies, there's nothing more sexier to me than a woman who can sing to me. Today, ladies, you're going to be singing for me and my parents in today's Crooning for Love challenge. I'm going to split you into teams. Annie, you're with Dana. You have only 2 hours, so sing your heart out because someone will be going home tonight.
So there's going to be an elimination tonight, and I'm like, oh my God, it's really important for us to win this date with Frank. This is the only time we have to make an impression on Frank.
I tell Annie she really has to shine tonight, but now she just ignores my advice completely. I'm looking into her eyes, and something has changed between us. Like, she doesn't trust me anymore, doesn't think I'm here to help her. Can't you see I just want to make her a memorable character? But instead, I have a feeling she's up to something. Something different from what I have planned for her.
I'm really nervous. Like, Dana doesn't have the best voice. Oh no, you know. This is gonna be hard.
All right, girls, time's up. Time to sing for Frank. First up is Carrie.
You amaze me with those arms. Can't keep my hands off those sexy arms.
Next up, Kathy and Melissa. And now we have Felicia and Melody.
Come and play some games with me, together to victory. I knew from the start that I'd be in your heart. After level 2, hey, I'd be Tiger too.
Okay, Annie and Dana, you're up.
In my sleep, I'm dreaming of you. Don't know what I would do. Sleeping next to you is exactly what I wanna do. Love, love, love to sleep all day. Don't wanna get up, baby, I wanna stay. During the chorus, I can tell that me and Dana are starting to get a little bit off. Then basically, I just start to freak out a bit. I just feel like we're failing. I'm like, I have to do something here.
I feel the love around.
Dana, stop. Like, seriously, stop. Because I want to get freaky. It's not about your dick. It's about this love. I think it's going to stick like I'm in my mouth when I give you a job. Hey, parents, it's time to shut your ears. Because it's not about your dick.
Unfortunately, FCC regulations prohibit us from showing you any more of Annie's rap.
Because I'm going down to the basement, I'm going down to the basement, I'm going down to the basement to get myself some Frank.
What the hell is going on here? Who wrote these lyrics?
I just thought that I would add a little spice.
That's the word, spice. I gotta be honest, I thought you were gonna win up to that point.
Dana, I'm sorry. I think the rap did more harm than good. So I sort of just misjudged the situation. Honestly, Dana, I just thought that it would be funny. Like, honestly, I just felt like I had to step it up.
Annie, what have you done? You've ruined both yours and Dana's chances of winning this competition. Why would you do that?
Like, honestly, they're just words.
Annie, we don't even know who you are anymore. We thought you were a sweet, nice girl, but we don't even know who you are. How could you do that to Dana?
Honestly, I just seriously, like, panicked because I feel like I'm always in the bottom and I don't know how to get his attention.
That is no excuse for what you did. And right in front of Mr. and Mr. Maresca? How disrespectful. That is not what we had planned for you, not at all. You were supposed to win this challenge.
I just felt like I never get his attention. I just wanted to get his attention, you know?
Just go get ready for dinner, Annie, and think about what you've done.
It's time to have dinner with the family, but first, there is someone I need to speak with.
Like, listen, if my parents weren't there, you could have made the whole song about whatever the you wanted to say. I wouldn't have cared. I talk like that all the time, but not in front of my mom and dad.
No, it was bad, and I'm going to apologize to them at dinner.
Out of all the people in this house, that's the last thing we expect to come out of your mouth. I was like, shocker.
Do you know what it is? Like, honestly, I just, like, flipped out because I knew we were going to have a challenge and then an elimination, and I was like, I don't know what to do here.
I think I did go too far, but I just needed to do something just to, like, get some attention from Frank.
But, like, honestly, Frank, I definitely, like, see the way, like, you are with the other girls, and, like, you know, like, maybe we just have a different kind of relationship, but, like, I do get a little jealous. It's just, like, hard, but I just, like, feel like, you know, if you're not, like, feeling me, I don't want to be strung along. Like, if you're on the fence or, like, you don't know, that's one thing. But if you know now, honestly, just let me go because I don't want to be here longer and, like, have it be harder for me.
You know, I know Annie's down because I haven't really seen that much of her, but I didn't think she'd be this upset.
I know everyone's thinking, Annie, you totally made today really weird or whatever, so I'm just, like, not going to say anything because I already caused way too much drama today.
Girls, time for eliminations.
If I get to stay tonight, I'll probably try to be more aggressive. Just, you know, try harder to get Frank's attention in more productive ways, hopefully.
Ladies, I really believe that this challenge showed me a totally different side of all of you. But tonight, I do have to say goodbye to one of you. So now, there's two girls and only one key.
At this point, it's not about being important for me to stay. It's just more about I only want to stay if Frank likes me as more than a friend. I don't want to stay if Frank's just going to string me along. So at this point, if Frank isn't feeling me, I would just prefer for him to send me home.
I'm absolutely sure that, Annie, you do have feelings for me. Ultimately, it's my feelings that are at test here, and I owe everybody my honesty.
This is basically do or die for me. Either Frank will decide he has romantic feelings for me, or he'll decide it's just friendship.
And honestly, you are an amazing woman. Annie, please step forward. Annie, I'm so glad you're in my life, and I really hope that you and I can always be friends. I'm so sorry, Annie.
Don't be.
I'm going to have to ask you to leave my parents' house.
There was like a split second there when I thought like, oh, hey, I might not be going home.
You know, I really like Annie. I think she has a really fun, wild side to her. But in the end, I really couldn't see us going all the way. So I think the right thing to do is just end it now.
I have no idea how I got this far. Honestly, I thought I was leaving the first day. I definitely felt an attraction to him, and I felt a friendship bond to him. I mean, ultimately, usually I'm more used to men competing for me, so that's how I like it.
So that's the story of Annie and Frank, and how I tried my best to help Annie win Frank. We wanted her to go far. Maybe not win, but at least get into the top four girls. I don't know what she was thinking by singing that dirty rap song in front of Frank and his parents. Was she trying to get kicked off, or was she just really desperate to get Frank's attention, as she claims? It's weird. It's like I had this one conception about who Annie was, the girl I wanted to show the viewers, but she proved not to be that person after all. It almost makes me question some of my assumptions about the other girls, too. Anyways, after Annie pulled her little stunt, she no longer fit into the storyline I had crafted for her. So we had to let her go. Who knows what she would have done next? I was sad to see her leave. She was such a sweet underdog character. But I guess that's reality for you.
That was Anne Hirsch Frank the Entertainer in a Basement Affair, a radio play.
Rihanna!
This has been Classic Friendship, Episode 3, The One with the Stories. In this podcast has been worked by Matthew Cunningham, Anne Hirsch, Megan Rooney and Rosanna McLaughlin. And the musical indents were made by Lyndon Harrison. It's January 2014.
Serenade!